You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Soul Economy and Waldorf Education, Collected Works, Volume 303, translated by Roland Everett. This is Lecture 15 of 16 lectures and a question and answer period, given in Dornach on the 6th of January, 1922. What I have to tell you today mainly concerns the child's physical education. It is in the nature of this subject that I can talk about it only aphoristically, chiefly because in these matters people tend to have already formed their own opinions. When it comes to talking about physical development, everybody seems to have definite preferences or dislikes, which all too often strongly color people's theories about this subject. But everything issuing from personal sympathies or antipathies easily leads to fanaticism, which is something far removed from the real aims and workings of anthroposophy. Any form of fanaticism or agitation for this or that particular cause is entirely alien to the nature of the anthroposophical movement. All it wishes to do is to draw attention to the effects of various attitudes and deeds in life, and then to leave everyone free to relate personal sympathies and antipathies to the case in question. Only consider with what fanaticism the case for and against vegetarianism is being argued today, each under the umbrella of unassailable scientific proofs. And yet one cannot help noticing that never before has dilettantism been flourishing quite as much as in the defense of this or and other similar movements. It really is so that anthroposophy does not have the slightest leaning toward any form of fanaticism. It cannot be a party to those who, as ardent vegetarians, would wish to enforce their views upon people of a different attitude, and who, in their fanaticism, even go as far as to deny non-vegetarians a fully human status in society. If occasionally fanaticism does creep into the anthroposophical movement, it does not reflect the true nature of anthroposophy at all. Now, there is one more aspect which we have to consider within the context of these lectures. You will have noticed that the main emphasis with regard to the educational principles presented so far has always been that we must take appropriate measures in the child's soul spiritual realm, so that the physical development will have the best possibilities of unfolding naturally and healthily. One could say, we are studying an educational system which, provided it is put into practice correctly and effectively, offers the best means toward a healthy physical development. Hence, the fundamentals of a sound physical education have already been given. Nevertheless, it is good to review and summarize them once more, even though this can be done only aphoristically, because of shortage of time. To do proper justice to this subject would mean my having to devote a whole lecture cycle to it. Our theme naturally falls into three main parts, which are the way we feed the child, the way we relate the child to conditions of warmth or cold, and our approach to gymnastics. Fundamentally, these three categories comprise all that is of importance for the child's physical education. Present-day means of knowledge, based as they are on an intellectualistic approach, do not offer us the possibility of coming to terms with the complex nature of the human organism. What is needed, despite the scientific attitude of which the present-day public is so proud, is that we acquire a certain instinctive knowledge of what is healthy or damaging to health, a knowledge which covers all the many grades lying between these two poles. A healthy instinct for these matters is really of immense importance, for is it not true to say that our general natural science is gradually becoming dyed more and more in the color of materialism? Just consider how many secrets have been wrested from nature through research under the microscope or through dissecting certain lower animals so that the functioning of their parts could be investigated. How many conclusions have been drawn with respect to human behavior by observing animal behavior, without taking into consideration the fact that the human organization, as far as its most important characteristic is concerned, is radically different from that of all the animal species. At least, not enough emphasis has been laid upon this significant difference, mainly because today's science depends on investigating every detail separately, thus obtaining only a partial view of life. Let me try to illustrate the situation by a comparison. Imagine that I meet two persons at 9 o'clock one morning. They are sitting on a bench, and I stop for a while to talk to them about various things, thus gaining a general impression of their characters. Then I go on my way again. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I see them still sitting on that same bench. Now, there are various possibilities of what may have happened in the meantime. It may be that these two persons have been sitting there on that bench the whole time, talking together. Or, according to the different ways in which people belonging to different races or nationalities behave, quite other things may have happened. Perhaps they have been sitting together in silence. Or, again, unknown to me, one of them may have gone away soon after I had left, while the other remained sitting on the bench. The former may have returned just before my reappearance, and so on. Outwardly, nothing appears to have changed between 9 a.m. and 3 p.m., despite the fact that the two persons were very different in temperament and lifestyle. Life will never reveal its secrets if one observes outer appearances only. And yet, with our present-day scientific methods, this happens far more frequently than is generally realized, as anyone can find out for himself. Present-day scientific attitudes can lead to a situation such as I witnessed not long ago. In my young days, I once had a friend whom I knew to be living a normal and healthy life. Subsequently, we went our different ways and did not meet for many years. Then one day I visited him again. When he sat down to his midday meal, the food was not served in the usual way, but a pair of scales was put on the table. With these he weighed the meat and the vegetables, for he had begun to eat scientifically. He had complete faith in science, which prescribed the correct amounts of the various foods to be consumed if one wished to be a healthy human being. Needless to say, such a method may be perfectly justified under certain conditions. But nevertheless, it will thoroughly undermine any healthy instincts. Yet these instincts, for what is wholesome or damaging to health, are a most essential attribute of any teacher and educator worthy of his calling. He or she will surely know how to elaborate and make use of all that has already been given in the previous lectures, also with regard to the physical education of the child. We have seen, for instance, how, before the change of teeth, the child lives entirely in its physical organism. This applies especially to the baby stage, and particularly so with regard to nourishment. As you know, when a baby begins to take in food, it is completely satisfied with a totally uniform diet. If an adult were to have to live day in, day out, on exactly the same kind of food for breakfast, lunch, or any other meal, he would find it quite intolerable, both physically and mentally. The adult, likes to vary his food. He likes a mixed diet. The baby, on the other hand, does not get any change of food at all. And yet only very few people realize the bliss with which a baby receives such a, in quotes, monotonous diet. For its whole body becomes saturated with intense sweetness from the mother's milk. A grown-up has the possibility of tasting food only with his taste buds and their adjacent organs. He is unfortunate in that all his sensations of taste are confined to the head, and thereby he is so very different from the baby, whose entire body is one great sense organ of taste. At the end of the baby stage, this way of tasting with the whole body ceases, soon to be forgotten for the rest of life. People who live with ordinary degrees of consciousness are completely unaware of how different their sensations of tasting food were during their babyhood. And true enough, later life does its best to wipe out this memory. To give you an example, I once took part in a conversation between an abstainer and another person of the opposite view. The abstainer, who, like so many like-minded people, was also inclined to be fanatical, tried to convert the gourmand, who replied, "I won't tell you the whole story, for it would take us too far from our theme. Quote, but I have been totally abstemious for 2 full years. Greatly surprised, the abstainer asked him when. The answer came pat, quote, during the first 2 years of my life. Close quote. In this humorous, though rather frivolous, manner, important facts of life were talked about. Only very few people have a deeper and proper knowledge of them. A baby is related to its physical body in such a way that it can only eat with its entire physical organization, deriving the utmost benefit and pleasure from this condition. The gradual transition to the next stage consists in the fact that forces begin to concentrate in the head region, finally bringing about the change of teeth. These forces are so powerful that they can push out the milk teeth and push the second teeth through. This is a slow and gradual process which takes place between birth and second dentition, affecting various other regions. After the stage of babyhood, the sense of taste withdraws into the head. The child no longer eats with its physical organization only, but soul forces too are involved in the act of eating. The child learns to discriminate, also by means of its soul forces, between the various tastes. At this stage, it is important to watch, with understanding, the child's reactions to different foods. Its likes and dislikes in themselves are a valuable indication for healthy or unhealthy inner conditions. But in order to be able to judge such questions, we need to have acquired at least an elementary knowledge of nutrition. When talking about this subject today, people generally think of the weight aspect. This, however, is not the essential point. What really matters is the fact that each kind of food contains a certain amount of forces. Each item of food holds a definite total of forces by means of which it has become adapted to conditions of the outer world. What goes on inside the human organism, on the other hand, is something entirely different. The human organism must completely transmute the food it has taken in. It has to transform the processes undergone by the various foods during their growth into those which are to be active within the human organization itself. What goes on there is a continual conflict, during which the dynamic forces contained in the food are metamorphosed into something entirely different. It is this inner reaction to substances eaten which we experience as stimulating and as something that sustains life. This is the reason why it is not good enough merely to ask how much in weight of this or that food must we eat, but rather how does our organism react to even the smallest amounts of certain food substances. For the human organism needs these forces which generate resistance against outer natural processes. Processes going on in certain areas of the human organism, roughly speaking between the mouth and the stomach, though somewhat modified, can still be compared with forces occurring in the external world. However, those taking place in the stomach and in the subsequent stages of digestion already are very different from what can be found outside the human being. But when it comes to what is happening in the head region, one finds there exactly the opposite processes from those occurring in outer nature. This shows how the human organism, in its totality, has to be stimulated in the right way through the food taken in. As I have to be brief, there is no time to go into the terminology representing the deeper aspects of this subject. However, for our present needs, a less specialized and more popular terminology will suffice. As you know, there are foods which in ordinary life are called rich in nutritive value, and others which are called poor nutriments. It is possible to live on food of only poor nutritive value. Just think of how many people are fed mainly on bread and potatoes, both of which definitely have a low nutritive value. On the other hand, you have to remember how, in cases of ill health, great care has to be taken not to burden the patient's digestion by feeding him on foods containing little nourishment. Bread and potatoes make very great demands upon the digestive system, with the effect that only little will be left over for the remaining functions. Therefore, a diet of bread and potatoes is hardly likely to promote physical growth. Other foods are looked for, foods which do not put an undue strain upon the digestive system, foods which make the digestive system work but little. However, if these things are taken to extremes, an abnormal activity is set up in the brain. This, in turn, will set into motion other processes which have no resemblance whatever to those going on in external nature. These again affect the remaining human organism, and in consequence the digestive system will relax, it will become too slack. All this is extremely complicated, and it is extraordinarily difficult to penetrate all the ramifications of what is happening there. It is one of the most difficult tasks of a thorough scientific investigation, not the kind so common today, to really know what is happening when, for instance, a potato or a piece of roast beef is put into a human mouth. Each of these two processes is very complex, and each is very different from the other. In order to investigate the subsequent stages of digestion with scientific precision, a great deal of specialized knowledge is necessary. A mere indication of what is happening there must suffice. Imagine that a child eats a potato. First, the potato is tasted in the head, the seat of the organs of taste, and the sensation of taste is then induces further reactions. Though the sense of taste no longer permeates the child's entire organism, it nevertheless has certain effects upon it. Now, a potato does not have a particularly stimulating taste, and consequently it leaves the organism somewhat indifferent and inactive. The organs are not particularly interested in what is happening there with the potato in the child's mouth. The potato is then passed on into the stomach in the ways known to you. The stomach, however, does not receive it with alacrity either, because it has not been previously stimulated by the sensation of its taste. Taste always provokes the stomach to take in food with either more or less sympathy. In this case, the stomach will not exert itself in order to incorporate the potato with its dynamic forces. Yet this must happen, for the potato cannot be left lying there in the stomach. If the stomach has the necessary strength, it will absorb the dynamic forces of the potato, working on them with a certain distaste. It allows the potato to enter without developing a marked reaction to it, because it does not feel stimulated by it. This process continues in the remaining digestive tract, where what is left of the potato again is worked upon with a certain reluctance. Only very little of what once was the potato ever reaches the head organization. These few indications, which ought to be deepened considerably for any proper understanding, are to give you a mere impression of the complex nature of the processes going on in the human organism. Nevertheless, an educator ought to acquire a working knowledge of these things, and in order to do so, I believe it to be necessary for him or her to go into the why and wherefore. I could imagine that some of the listeners might think it good enough simply to be told what to give to children to eat and which kinds of foods to avoid, but this won't do. For in order to act rightly, especially when matters of a physical nature are involved, the educator needs to have sufficient insight into the problems. There are so many possibilities of dealing with them that one needs to be guided along the right path in order to recognize what needs to be done in each particular case. And for this, the teacher needs at least a simplified picture of how a child should be fed. Perhaps no other realm does one notice quite as much how far educational principles have deviated from prevailing social conditions as in the case of physical education. Unless pupils happen to live in boarding schools where one is able to put into practice what I have been indicating, one will find it necessary to win the cooperation of parents or others in charge of children, and this, as we all know, can cause considerable difficulties. Only after overcoming great obstacles may it be possible to implement measures which one deems right and beneficial for a pupil. Let me give you an example. Imagine you have a pupil of an excessively melancholic disposition in your class. Extreme symptoms of this kind always indicate an abnormality in the physical organization. Abnormalities in the soul region always have their basis with physical abnormalities of one kind or another, and physical symptoms are a manifestation of the soul and spiritual life. So let us imagine that there is such a child in a day school. In a boarding school, one would, of course, deal with such a problem in cooperation with the dormitory. What would I have to do? First, I must try to establish a contact with the child's parents. And if I am absolutely sure about the real causes of the problem, I may have to ask them to increase the child's sugar consumption by at least 150%, and in certain cases even by 200%, compared with what is given to a child who behaves normally. I must advise the parents not to withhold this additional amount of sugar, which could be given, for instance, in form of sweets. Why am I doing this? Perhaps it will become clearer to you if I take the opposite case as an example. Let us imagine that I have to deal with a pathologically sanguine child. If what I am saying is to make sense, we must take an abnormally sanguine case. We must imagine an excessively sanguine child. Again, its symptoms betray an abnormality within the physical organization, and in this case I should have to ask the parents to decrease the sugar content given to the child. I must ask them to reduce greatly the amount of sweetness given to the child. What are my reasons? One can find out to what extent one has to increase or decrease sugar content only if one is aware of the following facts. Mother's milk, in particular, but all milk and milk products, spread their effect uniformly throughout the entire human organism in such a way that each organ receives what it needs in an harmonious manner. The other foods, on the other hand, exercise their influence more upon one particular organic system. Please note, I am not saying that the other foods exercise an exclusive influence, but a predominant one upon the various organs. The way in which a child or an adult responds to a specific taste or to certain kinds of foods depends on the general condition of a particular organic system. In this respect, certain luxury foods play as important a part as do ordinary foods. Milk affects the entire human being, whereas other nutriments affect one particular organic system. With regard to sugar, we must turn our attention to the activity of the liver. So what am I doing if I give an abnormally melancholic child plenty of sugar? I diminish the activity of the liver, because sugar, in a certain sense, takes over the activity of the liver. The liver activity is now directed more toward something extraneous, and consequently the liver's activity is reduced. In this way, it is possible purely by dietary means to lessen a supermelancholic tendency in a child, which can also appear as a tendency toward anemia. For under certain circumstances, pronounced melancholic symptoms can be the consequence of a child's liver activity. And what am I doing if, in the case of a supersanguine child, I recommend a reduction of sugar intake? Here I try to lessen the activating effect of sugar in order to induce the liver to become a little more active by itself. In this way, I stimulate the child's ego forces, thus helping him or her to overcome the physical symptoms of a supersanguine temperament. This example illustrates that it is possible to counteract certain abnormalities if one observes the human physical organization as an entity. Consequently, the why and wherefore is of importance. Naturally, there are always countless details to contend with, but it is quite possible to relate these to the wider aspects, which generally lead to polarities. A really good teacher, an even better one than those who exist already, through close contact with his pupils, would know prophetically and instinctively what to do with the child under given circumstances. In any case, it is of utmost importance for the teacher to perceive any deviations from a child's normal and healthy behavior, so that he can take appropriate action. If one practices such close attention for a longer time, one generally learns to find out what preventative measures need to be taken. As a rule, this faculty is developed only if an alert and dedicated teacher has made it his second nature to spot even slightly unusual symptoms in his pupils. Obviously, one must never allow abnormal features to deteriorate to an extreme degree before taking action. In order to achieve this ability, a teacher must be willing to deepen his understanding all the time, and also to overcome many personal hindrances. Otherwise, I am afraid that teachers will attain the necessary thoroughness only by the time they reach their retirement. What one has to watch very closely is, on the one hand, the interest which the child, as a being of body, soul, and spirit, shows not only for him or herself, but also for the environment. One has to develop an instinctive awareness for the child's interest, or for the lack of it. This represents the one pole. The other consists in the pupil being aware of the first signs of fatigue in the pupils. Where does each child's characteristic interest come from? It has its seat in the metabolic and limb system, but mainly in the metabolism. If I see that a child loses interest, let us say in matters involving mental activities, and this is the most obvious case, or if it shows little interest for outer activities, if it no longer wishes to take part in games or similar pursuits, or if I see that it even loses interest in its food, the worst sign of all, for children by nature are interested in the tastes of different foods, and they should learn to distinguish between the various tastes. If a child suffers from lack of appetite, for lack of appetite is lack of interest in food, then I know the cause lies in a wrong diet. The food given to such a child makes too great a demand upon its digestive system. I must find out what kind of food, containing relatively little nutritive value, is being given to this child, food that overloads and burdens its digestive system. Just as I can deduce the weather from reading the barometer, so can I deduce a wrong diet by noticing a marked lack of interest in a child. Interest or apathy are most important pointers with regard to the right diet for the child. Now let us look at the opposite pole. If I notice that a child tires too quickly through either mental or physical activities, again I can trace back the cause to physical conditions. In this case, the child may eat with a normal appetite, but after taking in food, it may sink into a state of drowsiness, not unlike that of a snake after feeding. If after a meal a child has an abnormal desire to curl up on the sofa, it is a sign that it cannot cope with its digestion properly, that it becomes exhausted by the activity of digestion. It is a sign that it has been given too much food of the kind which does not stimulate the digestion sufficiently, with the effect that the unfulfilled demands of its digestive system now enter the child's head region, thus causing fatigue. If a child shows a marked lack of interest, I must give it food of concentrated nutritive value. There is no need to wax fanatical about these things. Fanatical vegetarians will say, this child shows lack of interest, and it has been fed on meat. You must get it used to a diet of raw fruits, and it will recover its interest again. This may be the case. On the other hand, those who believe in giving meat to children will maintain, if a child tires too easily, one must stimulate it with a meat diet. These things should not provoke too much argument, simply because it is quite possible to balance different kinds of foods through appropriate combinations, which in this case might well take the place of meat. Nor is it essential to turn children into vegetarians. What matters is that one recognizes that lack of interest in a child can be overcome by an improved diet, namely by feeding it on specially nutritious foods, and that, on the other hand, a tendency toward fatigue can be overcome by working in the opposite direction. This is one way of simplifying a highly complicated subject for easier understanding. If, for instance, I find that a child tires too easily, I must realize that its digestion is not sufficiently engaged. Hence, I must alter the diet accordingly. We must learn to develop a kind of human symptomatology, which will help us forward in a concrete and practical way. It is not always necessary to go into all the details. If, in matters of nutrition, one interprets certain symptoms correctly, one will learn to see through a given situation and know what steps to take. Closely related to all this, and yet in a certain sense its very opposite, is the whole question of warmth in childhood. Here, external phenomena offer an even clearer guideline than in the case of nutrition. We only need to interpret them correctly. On the other hand, they easily lead to exaggerations, and then they can become harmful. Well, the catchword I am referring to is, in quotes, hardening, in quotes, toughening up. Under certain circumstances, this can be a good thing, and much has been done in its favor. And yet, if one stands on firm ground with regard to knowledge of man, one can't help feeling thoroughly alarmed at seeing adults who, in their childhood, were systematically hardened and who are now unable to cross a hot and sunlit square without feeling oppressed by the heat. This can reach such proportions that their psychological as well as their physical makeup actually stops them from ever venturing across a sunny open square. Surely hardening can be right only if it enables a person to put up with physical hardships of any kind. When considering the question of warmth or cold, two facts need to be borne in mind. First, that nature has given us a clear directive in that we feel well only so long as we are unaware of the temperature surrounding us. If we are exposed to too much heat or cold, we very quickly lose our sense of well-being. Obviously, we need to be able to perceive outer temperatures with our senses, but this must not have an adverse effect on our entire organism. To protect ourselves from heat and cold, we neutralize their effects by the kind of clothing we wear. If a human being is exposed to too much cold, he or she becomes capable of keeping certain inner organs functioning normally. If, on the other hand, outer temperatures are too high, the body will react by an excessive functioning of these organs, so that one can say, if a person is exposed to abnormally low temperatures, his inner organs develop the tendency of coating themselves with a layer of mucus, thus giving rise to the type of illnesses which, coining a popular expression I should like to call, quote, internal mucositis, close quote. Organs are being lined with metabolic excrescences, and this process results in a hypersecretion of mucus. If, on the other hand, a person is exposed to too much heat, these organs will react by drying up. A tendency of forming crusts develops, while the organs themselves ossify and become anemic to a high degree. This way of looking at the human organism will give us the right indications of how to proceed in educational matters. Every symptom, every phenomenon can teach us something. For instance, as human beings, we can safely expose our faces to much colder temperatures than other parts of our body. By being exposed to greater degrees of cold, the face actually prevents the other organs from drying up. It stimulates these organs, and there is a continuous interplay going on between the face, which readily accepts certain degrees of coldness, and the other members of man's physical organization. However, we must not mix up the position of our face with that of a different part of our anatomy. Forgive me for putting it so crudely, but we must not confuse a person's face with his or her calves. This is the kind of mischief one comes across so frequently today. For in cold weather, children are allowed to walk about with bare legs up to their knees, and sometimes even higher up. This, in fact, is a real mixing up of the two ends of the physical body, of the human physical body. If people were aware of the hidden interconnections between such things, they would realize how many cases of appendicitis, developing in later years, are linked to this confusion between the two human extremities. On the other hand, it also needs to be said that one should not be oversensitive to minor changes of temperature, and that children should be brought up to bear them with equanimity. If a child overreacts to slight changes of temperature, we must know that once again we can help by making corresponding changes in its diet. These are the things which show us that warmth and nutrition have to work together, for eating and keeping warm are complementary to each other. If someone is oversensitive to changes of temperature, he or she should be given food of high calorie content, which will generate inner strength to withstand outer changes of temperature. Again, you can see how a real knowledge of man can help also in such a situation, and how, fundamentally, everything within the human organism not only must work together harmoniously, but above all, how those entrusted with the task of educating the young must be able to recognize this cooperation among the various organs. The third major aspect regarding physical education concerns the various forms of movement given to pupils. The human being is constituted in such a way that he has to be active not only within his own bodily functions, but he must also partake in the happenings of the external world. He must be able to experience himself as a link with the outer world. It is true to say that no separate organ of the human being can be understood properly if it is considered merely in a state of rest. Only if we relate it to the activities and movement inherent in its functioning are we able to understand it also in its state of rest. This is the case no matter whether it be an outer organ, the form of which even in its resting position already indicates the type of movement it has to perform, or an inner organ, whose shape and configuration in themselves are expressive of its function and mobility, thus making it part of the overall processes of the human organism. All this is taken into account if we introduce the various forms of movement to the child in the appropriate way. Again, we must bear in mind the wholeness, the totality of the human being, and we must aim at giving proper due to his physical, soul, and spiritual being. In the case of the child, this will happen only if we allow it to perform movements of the right kind and of a style which will give satisfaction, because they are in harmony with the child's innate intentions. Consequently, these movements will always be accompanied by a feeling of well-being. The first step in this direction, in an education based on knowledge of man, is to learn to understand the particular ways in which children want to move if given free rein. The kind of stereotyped games with their inhibiting rules are really quite alien to the young child's nature, for they suppress what should be left freely mobile within the child. Through such organized games, the child's own inner activity is gradually being dulled down. And as an activity is being imposed upon the child from without, it loses interest in such movements. This one can see quite clearly if one observes what happens when the free movements of a child at play are channeled too much into fixed gymnastic exercises. As I said before, I do not wish to condemn gymnastic lessons out of hand. But in general, one can surely say that when a young pupil is doing gym exercises, his or her movements are called forth from without. Anyone working out of a real knowledge of man would much rather see young children play freely on parallel bars, on the horizontal bar, or on rope ladders, instead of their having to follow the exact commands of a gym instructor shouting, 1, 2, 3, while they have put their feet on the first, second, or third rung of the rope ladder, or perform precise movements on the gym apparatus, movements which tend to impose stereotyped forms upon their bodies. I know that these remarks go a little beyond the general trend of modern gymnastics, whose advocates often are tinged with fanaticism. One easily rouses antipathy if one throws light on the kind of gymnastic exercises which are imposed from outside, and compares them with the child's natural movements arising out of its own involvement in free play. Yet it is precisely this free play which ought to be observed and studied. One must get to know the child intimately, and then one will know what to do in order to stimulate the right kind of free play, in which, of course, both boys and girls should take part together. In this way, through the inner mobility, which accompanies the children's outer movements, their organic functions will act together harmoniously. This method will also open one's eyes to what lies behind certain symptoms, such as those indicating anemia in young girls. In most cases, these symptoms are simply the result of the young girls having been artificially separated from the boys, because it was considered unseemly for them to romp about with the boys during free play. Girls, as well as boys, should be allowed to be boisterous in their free play, though the girls perhaps in slightly modified ways. The conventional ideas of what is ladylike, which so often are held up to young girls, are frequently contributory causes of anemia occurring in later life. I must ask you not to take this remark as a personal criticism of an established way of life, but rather as an objective observation. We can obviate a tendency toward anemia simply by allowing young girls, too, to engage in the right kind of free play. In this way, we safeguard their inner functions from becoming sluggish, to the extent that they are no longer able to form the right kind of blood out of the digestive activity. In our times, it has been difficult to win full understanding for these matters, simply because the kind of knowledge fostered today is not the outcome of observing the inner nature of man, but rather that of collecting detailed data. By the so-called method of induction, these facts are then made into some kind of hodgepodge of general knowledge. Admittedly, by following this method, it is possible to discover all kinds of interesting facts, but what really matters is to observe what is of significance for life itself. Otherwise, it might easily happen that an ardent admirer of modern science objects by saying, quote, "You have told us that anemia can be caused by young girls having been denied the possibility of free play. Yet I have come across several cases of anemia in a village where the young girls had by no means been restrained in their free play." Close quote. In this case, one would have to investigate the causes of anemia in this particular situation. It might have happened that as a child a girl once nibbled an autumn crocus, thus inducing a tendency to anemia, which developed in later life. Another important aspect of our theme concerns the consequences of mental strain in children. If we overburden their mental powers, we definitely exert a harmful influence upon their general condition of health. If we prevent the child from finding a natural relationship toward movement and play, its metabolic organization does not receive the necessary stimuli. By burdening the child with too much knowledge of the world, we artificially increase a metabolic activity in the head. Although man is a threefold being, all activities dominating one of the three spheres are, to a certain extent, also present in the other two systems. And if we overload a pupil, not with spiritual content, but with what the external world offers in the material realm, we divert some of the normal activity of digestion from the metabolic sphere to the head region, in this way calling forth a kind of abnormal activity of the entire metabolism. This too can lead to conditions of anemia during puberty. Again, someone might object by pointing out that in a certain village, where pupils are not at all subjected to intellectual pressure, such cases of anemia had occurred. Again, one would have to investigate the particular situation involved. For instance, it might then be discovered that one of the houses in this village was covered in Virginia creeper, and that a child whose curiosity had been roused by its black and glistening berries had eaten a few overripe ones, in this way increasing an already innate tendency toward anemia. In conclusion, I should like to say, to collect separate data and then extract from them general knowledge can be a perfectly correct method of procedure. But if one aims at the kind of knowledge which is closely allied to practical life, one has to observe the actual life situations carefully in order to find out where and how one should tackle the problems as they present themselves. Only a real knowledge of man will offer the educator this kind of insight into the human being, and it will enable him to fulfill his task by leading the child into the right forms of movement, and by being on his guard against subjecting the children entrusted to his care to too much mental strain. The realization of these possibilities is our first and foremost task. Of course, we cannot always prevent a child from sucking an autumn crocus or from eating the blackberries of the Virginia creeper. But what we can do is to infuse intuitions into the child, and this at the right time, which will enable it to develop physical powers in an all-round way and to cultivate greater flexibility. The end of Lecture 15.